Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1348, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 22. We're getting up there, boss. This is being recorded on the first day of fall of 2024, and that is September 22nd of 2024. And we are digressing from our discussion of Asia, and I'm really looking forward to getting back to that. When you've got obvious BS that appears to have a Nazi genesis, and not just Nazi genesis, but with a group that was going to network and perhaps has networked with the Azov Battalion in Ukraine, and that is being echoed by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. And then you've got a guy, and I think that the Lambert Streffer post raises some interesting questions about Ryan Wesley Routh. Given all of his criminal convictions, he was convicted of possessing a machine gun. Was he able to do what he was able to do? And there is abundant, there are abundant indications of his attempted networking with the Azov Battalion, as well as the overlapping International Legion. And but those questions aren't being asked. I want to put in a plug again for the new 64-gigabyte flash drive, which will be available later this year. It had my entire life's work available on it, plus a mini library of old anti-fascist books, and all of the conversations with Monty will be on this new 64-gigabyte flash drive. I get no money whatsoever from this, and I guess the fact that I'm offering up my entire life's work, which has been pretty hard work, I'm now in my 46th year on the air, for no money could be seen as proof positive that my most malicious critics are correct and that, I am nuts. But that is neither here nor there, as it goes. Well, Monty, I want to apologize to you for having pontificated there, reading some of those things into the record. But again, I think...
Not at all. If I may, it provides the proper geopolitical and context for some of the more esoteric and arcane things I was speaking about at the beginning of the previous program about Guy Bannister and his connections to, esoteric Hitlerism and Setri Devi. And of course, Setri Devi's overlap into Gerald L.K. Smith's activities. And of course, the direct connections of Gerald L.K. Smith and his establishment to one of the founders of the Process Church of Final Judgment. You know, there's this esoteric cultural fascism that has permeated, politics of Trump, as it were, that has, a foundational structure within the fascist right on an international level, at least going back to the advent of Nazism, and certainly the worship of Hitler as a bodhisattva, which there were quite a few, intellectual fascists like Setri Devi that were doing just that. And we see that in organizations like Blood Brotherhood organization and organizations like Adam Waffen, for example, are involved in this, esoteric fascism, where it essentially is like a death cult of sorts,
It is, by the way, Savitri Devi, Savitri, last name Devi, is represented at length in the archives that are available it's all available on the SpitfireList.com website, but it will be available on the new 64-gigabyte flash drive, so people can look at that. Looking at some of the things that are taking place, I mean, the whole thing with the Haitians eating ducks and geese, and then that morphs from being an ideological presentation of Blood Tribe and Christopher Polhouse, who is going to network, his organization was going to fight with the Azov Battalion. And then all those questions about Ryan Wesley Routh. And again, just people can do A Google search, Ryan Wesley Routh and the Azov Battalion, they have disclaimed any connection with him. And yet, obviously, this guy is being handled. I mean, how was he able to do what he was able to do? It doesn't make sense. But so much of what's going on now is absolutely incredible.
Right.
So I saw an article discussing how the Council on American-Islamic Relations, you know, some people may have had their hackles raised when they claim there is no left. Well, there basically isn't. As the late brilliant political comedian Mort Saul noted in his 1976 autobiography, Heartland, quote, "There is, the CIA staffs the left, which they do. The Council on American-Islamic Relations has become the go-to organization for American Muslims. It is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist group. But they have noted that large numbers of American Muslims in Michigan are going to vote for Jill Stein because they don't want to vote for Kamala Harris or Donald Trump. If Donald Trump gets into office again, the Muslim population, not just of Michigan, but of the rest of the U.S. and the world, they are not going to like what happens. But then, you know, that's how it goes, you know, I don't know, late psychologist Wilhelm Reich, and while I don't agree with the whole orgone thing, in his book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, he posited that fascism was a collective political psychosis. And the more time passes, the more I'm able to see that taking place. People may have thought that some of our discussion about Spaz Rakin and the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and also Roy Frankhauser and his networking with not only the national security establishment, but you've got Nazis who were networking with Lee Harvey Oswald, including Dan Burroughs. I did not realize that he served under General Edwin Walker, and in the when Walker commanded troops were being used, I believe it was in Arkansas, to help guard the desegregation of the schools, Burroughs was thoroughly outraged. But that again, people go, "Man, I believe in conspiracy theories." A much more useful term is networking.
Right.
And there's an article, and let me bring that up. This again will be present in the archives, and please bear with me while I fiddle around with my computer, which, you know, I don't want to mess up anything in the recording studio here, but the article is, it's from Covert Action Quarterly, and the article is, "Imagined Geographies of Central and Eastern Europe, The Concept of Inframarium," by Marlene Laruelle, couple Laruelle, and Ellen Revere from Covert Action Magazine of March 23rd of 2019. And there is a good discussion of the continuity, the political continuity from World War II right on up to the present. And a good quote here. "The continuity of institutional and individual trajectories from the Second World War collaborationists to Cold War era anti-communist organizations to contemporary conservative U.S. think tanks is significant for the ideological underpinnings of today's Inframarium revival." And in For the Record 1096 and 1097, I discussed the Ukrainian Nazi Azov Battalion and other Ukrainian fascists looking to Ukraine as the epicenter of a worldwide national socialist revolution. And another thing that I have pointed out in a series of programs, 1098, 99, 1100, and I think 1101, maybe even 1102, but I think it was just 1101, Roman Svarych, that's the last name, S-V-A-R-Y-C-H. The spelling depends on the transliteration. But in the early 1980s, he was the personal secretary for Yaroslav Stetsko, the World War II head of the Ukrainian collaborationist government that cooperated with the Third Reich and implemented their ethnic cleansing programs in Ukraine. And Stetsko became basically the head, not only of the OUNB, but also of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, Spas Rakin, who met Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina Oswald upon their return from the Soviet Union, was affiliated with that group. And Svarych was not only the justice minister, the equivalent of attorney general under Viktor Yushchenko, but also both Timoshenko governments, and he was the spokesperson for the Azov Battalion, and according to Andrei Beletsky, one of the founders of that organization, Roman Svarych was a person who recruited for it and helped to finance it through an NGO. And so what we've got with the Azov Battalion, which was networking apparently with Christopher Polhaus, and although they disclaim it, Ryan Wesley Ralph was hanging around with them in Ukraine, is a direct continuity between World War II fascism and what's going on today. And it is surreal to me. And I'm no big fan of Kamala Harris, God knows. But it's kind of like what we're facing now is a rerun of 2016, and what we've got in the presidential election campaign is a choice between what would you like for dinner, a chicken fried steak dinner at Denny's or a plate full of broken glass. And I certainly don't think, as an old short order cook, I know only too well what goes into a chicken fried steak dinner at Denny's. You know, you get the little mixed vegetables which come out of the can, the mixed carrots and the diced carrots and peas, and you get your choice of soup or salad, and the soup comes out of the can. The salad, you've got a little bit of iceberg lettuce, some grated red cabbage and carrots for color, and croutons on the top. They've been, you know, made long in advance, so they're not fresh. And then you get your chicken fried steak dinner with either mashed or baked potatoes, and it's loaded with salt. It's got a fair amount of sugar in it. It's carcinogenic as hell. And if you eat that on a steady diet, you will die. But it won't kill you immediately, and it will sustain you. There are people around the world who love to get a chicken fried steak dinner at Denny's as opposed to no food at all. They're starving to death. But it's surreal to me to see people who should know better, who are going to support Donald Trump, people who are even members of labor unions who are going to get screwed under a Trump administration, or older people who need Medicare and Social Security, which the Republicans are looking to cut. I don't know, Marty. I'll be interested in some of your thoughts and reactions and presentations in this context, because what we have seen in the presidential debate and its aftermath is we have seen a Nazi meme being echoed by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, and that should come as no surprise. One of the things that's available on the forthcoming 64-gigabyte flash drive in the mini library of old anti-fascist books is the book Undercover, a 1943 publication by John Roy Carlson. And he infiltrated the powerful Nazi underground in the United States during World War II. And by the way, a guy named Edward Hunter, who's mentioned in the Caulfield book about Edwin Walker, is also in that book. But one of the Christian fascists who was fronting for the Nazis in the World War II period was Reverend Norman Vincent Peale, who was fronting for Edward James Mulney, maybe it's James Edward Mulney, a pivotal early Nazi Party member in the U.S. Well, Norman Vincent Peale was the guy who married Donald Trump and his first wife, Ivana. And Ivana testified or communicated to Vanity Fair magazine that Donald Trump kept a copy of a book of Adolf Hitler's speeches called Mein New Order, published as a sequel to Mein Kampf, in a night table, in a nightstand for late night reading of one of the people who was promoting Donald Trump's candidacy was Helena von Dahn, a protege of Otto von Bolsing, who drew up the list of appointments for Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California, then moved to the White House and became special White House assistant for presidential personnel, did the same thing there. She then became U.S. ambassador to Austria, and her husband at the time, a guy named Gertler, conveniently committed suicide after Helena von Dahn went home. And one of the people that von Dahn apparently recruited was a woman named Ekaterina Chumachenko, part of the OUND milieu. She became a special White House assistant for public liaison. She was an assistant for public liaison under the Reagan administration. She then married Viktor Yushchenko, who not only named Stefan Bandera but Roman Shukevich as heroes of Ukraine. He established the Institute for National Remembrance under Volodymyr Vyatrovich, which basically erased the true history of World War II. And eventually, again, she became, Ekaterina Chumachenko, became First Lady of Ukraine. Another person who promoted Donald Trump was Pat Nixon, Richard Nixon's widow. Richard Nixon was a protege of Alan Dulles, and he oversaw the Republican Ethnic Outreach Committee, which was basically a Nazi wing of the Republican Party. It was the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations crew, the Romanian Iron Guard, the Ukrainian OUND, the Bulgarian National Front, the Croatian Ustashi, etc. The chief spokesperson for that group was Ronald Reagan, the guy who made the who handled the State Department machinations to bring these people into the U.S. was William Casey, who was appointed by Alan Dulles to be in charge of operations inside of Nazi Germany in late 1944 and 1945, and appears to have been involved with the setting up of the networks that morphed into the Republican Party. And those, whereas the Republican Ethnic Outreach Heritage Outreach, I've forgotten the exact name, it had only coalesced in presidential election years. It became a permanent part of the Republican Party under George Herbert Walker Bush, who was Ronald Reagan's vice presidential candidate. William Casey was his campaign manager, then became his CIA director. So there is a direct line here. And perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised to see Trump and J.D. Vance basically parroting a Nazi meme about Haitian immigrants, and that is being bandied about on the national stage. It's just, you know, Marty, on the one hand, I knew something like this was going to happen. Yet there's part of me that really is incredulous. You know, can this really be happening? I need to pinch myself at times. And it,
well, it reminds me of something that Dr. Josef Mengele commented before a group of, what can I say, soon-to-be slave laborers that were about to be worked to death, who got off of a train at Auschwitz one day in 1943. Mengele said, "The more that we do to you, the less you'll believe it's happening."
Well, you know, he knew what he was talking about.
I think he captured the shock and awe of just the sheer levels of brutality and outright cultural, what can I say, regression or de-evolution as a species that's taking place right now in the political right on a global scale. I mean, these idiots are teetering with the end of everything in the Ukraine right now and in Israel. I mean, I'm sorry to say, and I'm sorry to sound alarmist, we are teetering, not only with a regional conflict in the Middle East and Ukraine and what's going on in Taiwan right now in the South China Sea, with a global conflagration, you know, and I'm hesitant to even call it a third world war, because what will come after that will be the end of civilization as we know it, you know?
It is. I mean, the choice between Donald Trump, I mean, if Kamala Harris continues the national security policies of Joe Biden, it could very well result in a nuclear war in Ukraine? Who knows? I mean, Israel's a nuclear power, and whereas I've been a supporter of Israel for most of my life, I no longer am. That ended about, 2010, the early part of the last decade. Israel has gone fascist now, and now you've got fascist and Nazi elements in charge of both Israel and the...
It's interesting to note that we, you and I had a Patreon program, some time back about, American intelligence elements that had infiltrated Fidel Castro's revolution, right? I don't know if you remember doing that Patreon few months back.
I do.
Okay. So, in that Patreon program, I pointed out that Frank Sturgis, who is infamous as one of the Watergate burglars in American politics. And of course, those that know their history know that Frank Sturgis was also an anti-Castro commando who served as a cutout for CIA covert operations all throughout the Caribbean, primarily in Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and of course, Cuba. It's fascinating to note that Frank Sturgis was always actively identified by the CIA as being either a cutout or a non-employee asset, right? So he was never identified as an actual CIA structural agent. And I pointed out in that program that Frank Sturgis, and this is confirmed by Professor Jeffrey Bale in his dissertation that was published by Rutledge University Press called The Darkest Sides of Politics, Part One. Inside of Professor Bale's work, Frank Sturgis is positively identified as having a paymaster by the name of Haviv Scheber. And it's fascinating to note that Haviv Scheber, not only was he an adherent of Gerald L.K. Smith in the 1950s, but Scheber himself, by 1981, became the president of the Holy Land Committee, the Crusade for a Holy Land Committee, which was the Israeli wing of the World Anti-Communist League. So, I know it's difficult once again for your listening audience to appreciate this, but the fascist continuity in Israel is something that can be tracked all the way back to the anti-communist efforts that were taking place against Cuba in the late 50s and the all the way to the mid 1960s. And of course, who was Haviv Scheber's direct liaison with CIA Director William Casey under the Reagan administration? Well, it was none other than Yaroslav Stetsko, the commander of
as my late dear friend Abe Bussell said, "Oh my Aiken A blank blank." It is also really interesting too. If you go back, I made a comment in my last interview that some of the most important fascist groups and manifestations took place between the world wars, when some of the countries that were ranged against Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan and fascist Italy had colonies. And one of the areas where one sees direct networking, I've actually lost friends who were ardent supporters of Israel. They were conservative Zionists. When I talk about Vladimir Yabotinsky, he was one of the most important early Zionist leaders, and he was a fascist. And I've spoken about that in a miscellaneous archive show that recorded in September of 1983.
Make no mistake, several of Yabotinsky's lieutenants all throughout the 1930s, once again, I'm sorry to say this, but this is factual history. Go ahead and look it up, listening audience. Most of Yabotinsky's top lieutenants ended up creating an organization called UNGRN, which to this day is considered a state-sponsored terrorist organization that helped create what is now the modern-day Mossad. Most of the UNGRN cadre that came out of the Yabotinsky camp were trained by a Waffen-SS officer by the name of Otto von Bolschwig. And what was an SS officer doing in Palestine? Well, he was essentially making connections with separatist elements that were trying to fight the British, okay? And the Nazis were using anybody and everybody as emigre elements in Palestine, including the fledgling elements of UNGRN, who would eventually help create the Mossad. So there's, literally back to the 1930s, 1930s, a presence of Nazi intelligence within the separatist elements that were going up against the British and the Mandate of Palestine.
The correct answer is the Irgun, I-R-G-U-N. One of whose members was Menachem Begin. Miscellaneous archive show that I did in September of 1983, now 41 years ago, there is a link in the description for For the Record programs 13, 16, and 13, 17. I'm kind of rambling here, but there are links between Vladimir Yabotinsky, who, by the way, David Ben-Gurion referred to. I think he referred to him as Vladimir Hitler. He was a hero, and he was arguably the most important Zionist. One of the things that I find disappointing, disenchanting, is the failure of the pro-Palestinian side of this debacle to utilize somebody, both rhetorically and politically. David Ben-Gurion warned after the 1967 war. He said that if...
Hold that thought, Dave, real quick. I just want to say this much in defense of the Palestinian position and what they have done historically to fight fascism in the Middle East. It should be noted that under the Seventh World Muslim Congress in 1931, the most powerful communist organization in the Middle East that was actively fighting the fascists and the Imperial Zionists that sided with the British. It should be noted that the most powerful communist party in the Middle East was the Palestinian Communist Party, and they did commit combat troops to fighting the Nazis and the British-backed Zionists at the exact same time, and unfortunately they were slaughtered. Okay, so there was in fact a socialist insurgent element that did try to fight these elements, but unfortunately they went up against the fascists and the imperialists at the exact same time, and they were wiped out.
I'm really talking about the post-World War II period.
I get that.
But Ben-Gurion warned, and he's the fellow for whom the Tel Aviv International Airport is named. And he warned that if Israel held on to the occupied territories, that it would be the end of Israel as a democracy. One of the things that's been completely erased from history is that there was a significant element in the in early Israeli history in the Zionist movement who were doctrinaire socialists, and they saw Israel as a potential socialist country. I've seen paintings or drawings with the socialist Zionists in their Madras fatigues, linking arms with the Arabs, with their captains, and living happily side by side in their socialist Zionist paradise. But in the description for the record 13, 16, and 13, 17, there's not only a link to the show I did in 1983 talking about the fascist element in the Zionist movement, but there also is the text of a letter that I referred to in that program, and it was written to the New York Times in 1948, and the primary signatories are almost all Jewish, including Albert Einstein and Hannah Arendt, warning about the fascist manifestations in Israel, talking about how they were attacking labor unions. One of the things that Vladimir Yabotinsky was very firm about was that in the Zionist state, workers would not be allowed to strike. And his organization provided active support to Mussolini for his 1935 invasion of Ethiopia. They collected scrap metal for it. His Beitar cadre took military training at Mussolini's Naval Cadet School.
Real quick, I just want to note that the American advisor to the Ethiopian invasion by the Italians under Mussolini was a very strong proponent of the Christian nationalist, Christian identity movement ideology of Christian Israelism. And that military affairs advisor to Mussolini's forces in Ethiopia was General Pedro del Valle.
Oh, really? Well, he's
really.
What is your source for that, Marty? I'm not doubting it, but
no, that comes directly from Dr. Caulfield's work on the JFK assassination and General Walker.
Very good. That's a huge, huge book. But the The Ukrainian fascists and the fascist element in the Zionist movement, which has now taken over Israel, frankly. One of the people who is revered by the Ukrainian fascists is a guy named Semyon Petliura, the transliterations vary. You'll see it S-E-M-I-O-N or S-E-M-Y-O-N, and Petliura, P-E-P-L-Y-U-R-A or L-I-U-R-A. And his group were ardent fascists and butchers. They slaughtered tens of thousands of Jews in the newly created independent Ukraine in the immediate post-World War I period. And right. Eventually Petliura was assassinated by a Jew in Paris in the mid, in the 1920s. Paris in the 1920s was not very sympathetic to Jews or Judaism, but he was acquitted because his whole family had been butchered by Petliura's pogromus. Vladimir Yabotinsky was angling toward an alliance with Semyon Petliura. And,
that's right.
David Ben-Gurion referred to Yabotinsky as Vladimir Hitler, and he lobbied very heavily against the eventual interring of Yabotinsky's remains in Israel. Yabotinsky's personal secretary and a pallbearer at his funeral was Benzion Netanyahu, the father of and political mentor to Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister of Israel. But, you know, the pro-Palestinian side doesn't, you know, they, I think, have really dropped the ball in not taking a look at David Ben-Gurion, what he said about the occupation of the territories conquered in the 67 war, and his fervent opposition to Vladimir Yabotinsky, and whom he referred to as Vladimir Hitler. And there was a letter in the New York Times, a full-page letter that was signed by a bunch of former Israeli intelligence chiefs, including heads of the Shin Bet, Israel's military intelligence service, and also the Mossad. And they were very critical of Israel's policies in the occupied territories. They felt it worked against Israel. I am not aware, and maybe there has been, but I'm not aware of any networking that the pro-Palestinian side has done with them. And it seems to me that there is at least the possibility of that having borne fruit. But now what we have is an absolute horror show. And it really, the possibilities of nuclear war are just terrifyingly great. And whether it's in the
or if I may, you know, the possibilities of something far more devious than a thermonuclear war, an electronic war, which we're starting to see the cuticles, as it were, and the great hand that is electronic warfare. Okay, and what can I say? That is the essence of the latest string of attacks that have been committed against Hezbollah operatives. You know, it's an electronic warfare campaign. You know, and that's what's so, I don't know, I think scarier than thermonuclear warfare, the ability to infiltrate a country's entire technical infrastructure and then essentially shut it down like a light switch. I mean, that's a bit terrifying, you know, especially with what's going on in the political right in this country. I mean,
there was a commentary by a fellow who works for the South China Morning Post, and he flat out said, you know, it is remarkable. I'm not paraphrasing, but it's sure. Remarkable that there has not been any condemnation of what Israel did with the pagers, when what they did was the living definition of the word terrorism. I mean, that is a terrorism.
That's what I meant a few moments ago when I said state-sponsored terrorism. I mean, this is it, you know? It's black and white, clear as crystal.
And sometimes I'm ruminating here, but there are times when I don't regret what I'm doing, because I saw this coming such a long time ago. And I would say for younger listeners, again, there are two events that you really need to understand, and the fact that they are inextricably linked. One is the assassination of JFK. You know, the so-called progressive sector, all the people who are dumping on Kamala Harris or who dumped on Hillary Clinton, they don't take into account the fact that the U.S. had a coup d'etat on November 22nd, 1963. The U.S. is not a democracy. And it does not have a free press. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, I don't, you know, I'm no big fan of Hillary Clinton, to put it mildly, and I'm no big fan of Kamala Harris, to put it mildly. But anyone who gets to be president of the United States is going to have to hew dogmatically to American foreign and national security policy.
Well, that real quick, that reminds me of a quote from District Attorney Jim Garrison. In 1967, he was addressing a meeting of American newspaper reporters in Los Angeles, where he said the following to them. Specifically, he was addressing the New York Times and CBS, who had taken upon themselves, along with the CIA, to engage in a harassment program. And Garrison said something to the effect, and I think this best encapsulates what any incoming president has to deal with in the post-Kennedy assassination environment, and it's this. Garrison said, and I quote, "When a president can lie with impunity, he can murder with impunity." Okay? Yep. So that's the political environment that we're in right now, on both sides, the left and the right, you know?
Well, maybe Donald Trump's attorneys argued in a federal appeals court that if, as president, he ordered SEAL Team 6 to murder a political rival, that he would be immune from criminal prosecution. And that is something that just really has not registered. But, you know, the people who are supporting.
Well, once again, I laugh at that. I scoff at that, truly, because this is so representational of all of the research that you've done about the connections between Watergate and the Kennedy assassination. I mean, let's face it, the men that in all likelihood committed the break-in into the Democratic National Headquarters in 1972 and 73, these men in all likelihood represented the cream of the crop of the United States military's special operations apparatus. You know, so what Trump's attorneys are espousing, or what they have espoused in the past about, you know, Trump having, you know, immunity for, you know, murdering a political operative, we have a precedent to that. And that is Richard Nixon and the plumbers teams. Every single one of those men, Virgilio Gonzalez, Emilio Martinez, E. Howard Hunt, James McCord, Frank Sturgis, those men were special forces. They were commandos, and they were assassins. That's documented. And so what's to be said?
Hunt was in charge of special operations in Japan, because we will be coming back to Asia in our
right. Not only that, but he was the chief of covert action for the OPC in Mexico City, and then he later in 1965 became the chief of intelligence for all NATO special forces activities. Okay, so you know Hunt in of himself is a very deadly asset to Western intelligence in the 60s. But please continue.
It's really interesting too. I saw a recent post that linked to a video of a John Lennon concert song talking about whether the film was, you know, Give Peace a Chance or Imagine. And
I think it was Imagine.
For the record, 1320, I think you're right. For the record, 1321, I talk about right. The assassination of John Lennon, and it appears that I've forgotten his first name, but his last name was Perdomo. He was
his full name is Jose Sanchez Maria Perdomo. Jose Perdomo.
And he was the, apparently the doorman, at least on that evening, when John Lennon was shot by, ostensibly by Mark David Chapman. Yet I've forgotten offhand whether the bullets that killed John Lennon came from his left and Chapman was
John,
to his right.
Categorically, Mark David Chapman was standing to John Lennon's right, to all the eyewitnesses. But Perdomo was standing roughly 11 to 15 feet to John Lennon's left, and that's where all the bullets entered Mr. Lennon's body, from the left side of his from the left side. So whoever fired upon him was standing in Mr. Perdomo's position.
And we see a direct link between the assassination of John Lennon and this whole milieu from the JFK assassination to Watergate to so many of the Iran-Contra. And
real quick, I just want to point this much out about Perdomo. Frank Sturges claimed in 1971 that Perdomo had died. This was later found out by the late great Mabe Russell that to be a falsehood. And Perdomo was in fact alive. Not only that, but it was later revealed in CIA documents that yours truly uncovered that Jose Perdomo was initially hired as paymaster for Operation 40, which we all know is an assassination team that was created by the 5412-2 committee and the Psychological Strategy Board of the National Security Council. And we must remember that the chief of Cuban affairs for the 5412-2 special action committee within the Eisenhower administration was a lieutenant commander in the Navy by the name of Richard Milhouse Nixon. Okay, so that he was the commander of Operation 40.
That name rings a bell, and it's also very strange as we talk about the assassination of John Lennon. Yoko Ono had John Lennon's body cremated 36 hours after he was killed. So that certainly it made a forensic investigation extremely difficult. I'm working on an article for the Patreon site now. We'll probably have to do that on this program because it's too important to just keep to the Patreon channel. But Yoko Ono's father, Aisuke Ono, or Yosuke Ono, was a really important figure. Not only was Yoko Ono the great-granddaughter of the founder of the Yasuda Zaibatsu, but Yosuke Ono was a paymaster for Imperial Japanese Naval Intelligence prior to World War II, and he was the paymaster for a guy named Frederick Rutland, R-U-T-L-A-N-D, a British national. Remember, Rutland of Jutland, he flew a plane off of a battlecruiser at the Battle of Jutland in World War I, and he, again, I guess he had an affair with a married woman and was disgraced as a result, but he was then employed by the Mitsubishi Zaibatsu, teaching pilots to fly off of ships in the early 1920s. He was requisitioning aircraft for the Imperial Japanese Naval Air Arm, and his paymaster in 1933 in the U.S., the paymaster for Japanese Naval Intelligence, was Yoko Ono's father, Yasuki Ono. And he later became one of the most important Japanese bankers. He was the head of the Bank of Tokyo, which was the direct successor to the Yokohama Specie Bank, which 25% of which was owned by Emperor Hirohito. And that was the top bank for the moving abroad of the orgiastic wealth that was generated in considerable measure by the Golden Lily Program. And you've done on the Patreon channel. We'll have to come back to it, I'm sure, in our discussion of the.
And when we do come back to Yosuke Ono, it should be noted for all the listeners that Yosuke Ono, after World War II, as one of the founders and later president of the Bank of Tokyo, Mr. Ono was appointed to that position by Frank Tiarkus, who was the president of the J. Henry Schroeder Bank all throughout the Second World War and one of Adolf Hitler's top financial sponsors through an organization called the Circle of Economic Friends for the Reichsfuhrer SS that had a special bank account called Special Account S that was pumping $4 million into the SS every 24 hours from 1933 to 1945.
That's a nice chunk of change to do, but in those days it was a huge amount of money.
Huge amount of money.
And it's so funny because I talk about that in the first of the archive shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika from May 23rd, 1980. And it's just wild. And of course, now none of this necessarily means that Yoko Ono was involved with was complicit in the assassination of John Lennon, although that has been implied by some authors. But certainly not only her behavior with regard to cremating John Lennon's body 36 hours after his death. But subsequently, she was recommissioning a Shinto temple in Chicago, along with Rahm Emanuel, who became the U.S. ambassador to Japan. That temple had been burned down in the wake of Pearl Harbor, and it's That's difficult right. not to see that as part of the Obama administration now. Then Trump continued it, and now Biden has continued it. I'm sure Kamala Harris, if she gets elected, will continue it. Trump will definitely continue it. Really, they are waging economic war and perhaps hot war against China. So it just it is absolutely wild. I was not a big fan of John Lennon. I liked his early music with the Beatles. I thought, frankly, his post-Beatle career was an embarrassment. But he was beloved of people, and beloved by people, and it just really is frustrating to me to see them ignoring the circumstances surrounding the murder of someone that they revered. And again, the position of Yoko Ono herself, the step-great-granddaughter of the founder of the Yasuda Zaibatsu, and then her father is financing a guy who's working for Mitsubishi. And some observers have said that Frederick Rutland, who was being financed by Japanese naval intelligence through Yasuki Ono in San Francisco in 1933. They have seen Frederick Rutland as being very much involved with the factors leading to the attack on Pearl Harbor. So this may be, I'm rambling a bit, but what I call the sweep of history. You've really got to understand World War II, the real history of World War II. Not, you know, once upon a time, there was a very bad man named Adolf Hitler, and he did all sorts of terrible things, but along came, it would be better with an Elmer Fudd accent, which I can't do very well. There was a very bad man named Adolf Hitler, who did all sorts of terrible things, but along came the Allies, and they defeated Adolf Hitler. That was Britain and the U.S., and they took care of that. But along came another very bad man, Joseph Stalin, hypnotized all the Russians. I mean, it's this nonsense version of history. And, again, I think Yoko Ono, in terms of her behavior, cremating John Lennon's body so soon after his assassination, whereas that could have a proper forensic investigation, could have led to a serious criminal investigation of the assassination of John Lennon. But, you know, these national security hits don't get investigated. And her background and her behavior, I think, is very, very interesting indeed. And it's just, it is so fascinating to me to see Yasuki Ono as a paymaster for Japanese naval intelligence, financing a top spy working for Mitsubishi, whom some observers have said was fundamental to the development of the Japanese naval air arm and the capability to successfully attack Pearl Harbor. But it's just wild. I don't know.
Maybe it all means nothing, Dave. Maybe it's just all a big coincidence, you know?
Yeah, that's it. You know, just go to sleep. But I'm reminded of the official version of the death of Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler did not die in the bunker. He escaped. But there are various
Real quick, I just want to say this much. Not only did Adolf Hitler escape, but there's, in all likelihood, the head of the Reichsministry, Bormann, the head of the Gestapo, Heinrich Mueller, and the head of all SS special weapons projects, a general by the name of Kammler. In all likelihood, those men escaped as well.
Oh, absolutely. There's a very good book by some very conservative people, and one of the co-authors is this lesson of Ruffer, R-U-T-H-L, I think it's Dean Ruffer, but he's the head of the Federal Society, so he's certainly no liberal. But it's called The Hidden Nazi, and it's about Hans Kammler, and among the disclosures in that book is that SS officer Wernher von Braun, the head of the U.S. space program, deeply complicit with Nazi war crimes, and also Walter Dornberger, who was the military commander of Peenemünde Nordhausen, they contracted to work on General Electric's version of the V-2 rocket in December of 1944. The war was still going on then. And, of course, the general counsel for General Electric was the same powerful Wall Street law firm that incorporated General Electric in the 19th century, and that is Sullivan and Cromwell. And, of course, who's in charge of secret intelligence in Bern, Switzerland, and for the OSS in World War II? Drum roll fanfare. You take it, Marty.
Well, Alan Welsh Dulles, their top attorney, you know, and the head of their foreign affairs department.
And, you know, with regard to the pivot to Asia, General Electric was heavily invested in Imperial Japan as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It should be noted that the concessions of American General Electric and German General Electric overlapped in an entity called IG Farben, specifically a concentration camp turned slave labor manufacturing facility for IG Farben called Auschwitz Number 4, which was a subcamp of the super camp called Auschwitz Brunnenwerk. And inside of official cables between Sullivan and Cromwell and IG Farben's facility in Auschwitz, it's actually dubbed IG Auschwitz. And who was the 50% shareholder of German General Electric's holdings through IG Auschwitz? Well, it was the president of the DuPont Corporation, Henri DuPont, you know, so... Let's consider all of that when we talk about, you know, Japanese intelligence operations supporting American General Electric and of course the contract that they have with the V2 rocket program in Peenemünde under Dornberg, Kammler, and SS Major von Braun.
And von Braun, you know, I listened to I won't mention his name; it would be unkind, but. A fellow who was, he's somewhat of a luminary in the science field, and I heard him interviewed on one of the Pacifica stations, and he said Wernher von Braun was really surprised to learn about all the slave labor that was used to build the rockets. Surprise my A blank blank. He was the guy who recruited them, and he knew full well what was taking place. I mean, he was a war criminal of the first order.
And I should note that slave laborers that worked at an off-site facility actually building the ICBM A4 system, which was the two-stage version of the V2 rocket. This was the infamous America rocket that was built by Walter Dornberger that was meant to fire a wave-riding early scramjet called the Project Silverbug. The eyewitnesses that were at a facility called Mittelwerk building these A4 two-stage V2 rockets said that, you know, von Braun would show up in his SS uniform wearing a whip, and every once in a while he would string up personnel, slave laborers that were building these two-stage V2 rockets, the A4s. And what can I say? He would string them up with piano wire and whip them to death in front of the slave laborers. That's von Braun for you, yeah?
And, of course, he was head of America's space program when JFK was assassinated, and one of the things that JFK was proposing was to have joint space exploration with this former Soviet Union, particularly with regard to the race to the moon. The late political comedian Mort Saul, who was not incidentally one of Jim Garrison's investigators, was talking about von Braun, and his autobiography, self-serving autobiography, was called I Aim at the Stars, or I Aim for the Stars, I've forgotten which. And Mort Saul said, I aim for the stars, but occasionally I hit London. So it is, it's really, by the way, what is your source for, the discussion of the Mittelwerk and the two-stage V2 and von Braun?
Oh, that comes from volume 2 of the National Security Archives documents procured by Peter Kornblow from his National Security Archive website.
Okay.
And that's volume 2 of Operation Rusty. And it's a subsection of a greater operation called Dustbin. And that's all capital letters. D-U-S-T-B-I-N, which was Operation Dustbin was the original United States Army effort to hire Nazi scientists and make sure that the Soviets didn't get a hold of them. Dustbin and Operation Rusty eventually became Operation Paperclip and the Galen Organization.
Yes, indeed. And the roots, I mean, I've heard over the decades, Monty, people saying, oh, Dave Emery thinks everybody's a Nazi, blah, 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 blah. You know, what is going on today can only be properly understood when one understands the past that has led up to, whether you're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian debacle, where you've got fascist elements deeply involved in the leadership of both sides, among the victims there of the Palestinian people themselves are being slaughtered. And yet, if you take a look at the leadership of the Palestinian movement over the decades, you've got Haj Amin al-Husseini, a major general in the Waffen-SS. Then you've got Yasser Arafat, who was a protege of Otto Skorzeny. And then on the Israeli side, you've got Menachem Begin. Another group is called the Stern Gang that openly advocated for an alliance with Nazi Germany, again, to get Britain out of the Middle East. Yitzhak Shamir was the best-known member of the Stern Gang. You've got the Irgun with Menachem Begin. Now you've got Vladimir Jabotinsky's personal secretary was Benzion Netanyahu, the father of and political mentor to Benjamin Netanyahu, who also was getting submarines, diesel submarines for Israel from ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. I mean, you cannot understand what's going on, whether you're looking at Donald Trump, and he
Right,
is.
and I should note with the phenomena of eugenics that appears to be cropping up more and more with the tech junkies like Elon Musk, for example. It should be noted that the Israel's thermonuclear weapons and chemical and biological weapon programs have a foundational structure with the apartheid state of South Africa. Okay, and that's well documented.
It is, and there's a miscellaneous archive show again called South Africa, and it's South Africa and the Bomb, and it was mid-1980s show, and among the people involved with developing the apartheid South African bomb was the father of Peter Thiel, arguably the most important man in the Republican Party, and also Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum. His father was involved with a company called Escher Weiss, which, even though it was a Swiss company, was availing themselves of Nazi slave labor because they were building components for the Third Reich's prospective atomic bomb. And later, Escher
Right.
Weiss, when Klaus Schwab was working for him, his mentor was Henry Kissinger. They were working on components for the apartheid South African atomic bomb. Elon Musk got his start. His father ran an emerald mine in, drumroll fanfare, apartheid-era South Africa. Elon Musk has come right out and said the only people who should be allowed to vote are high-testosterone males, which is pretty interesting. And yet people are going along with this, and
I guess that cuts me out of the equation,
I wouldn't do much about it. But, again, when you see Donald Trump and J.B. Vance repeating a Nazi meme coming from one of the Nazi groups that was going to, apparently was networking with, or at least intended to network with, the Azov Battalion, then you've got this weird guy. I mean, how does Ryan Wesley Routh get his weapons? All of the questions asked in that Naked Capitalism post, and he was networking with the Azov Battalion, although they disclaim him. It reminds me of the way John Warnock Hinckley was
Right.
dismissed by the various Nazis that he was hanging out with. This is not an accident, and
No, no, no.
it's not happenstance. This is the outgrowth of things that have been going on for decades. And again, for young people, we're almost out of time. And our next series of broadcasts, we'll get back to the pivot to Asia, but we've touched on that here. And the head of Japanese naval intelligence at one point was Yoshio Okadami Yoshio. But this is no accident. I really encourage people to get, when it becomes available, the new 64-gigabyte flash drive that will have all of my life's work, plus a mini library of old anti-fascist books, and all of these conversations with Monty available on it. And this concludes For the Record program number 1300. and 48. I think I've got my numbers right. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 22. This is being recorded on September 22nd of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.